Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I'm your co-host, Paul David. I'll kick it over to my new guest host.
And I'm Maya, as Paul just said, his new guest host.
And we're joined today by Molly Johnson-Jones, the co-founder and CEO of Flexa. And we're going to talk about flexible workspaces and the future of tech, the future of work and tech. So first things first, welcome to the pod, Molly.
Thank you so much for having me.
So just to give our audience like a quick summary, Flexa is a platform that helps employers get discovered and boost their, you call it employer value proposition, EVP, and employer brand. Maybe say a little bit more about EVP, because that was like a new one for our audience, I guess.
There. Yeah, definitely. So I think for quite a long time, when we've thought about company working environments, we think about flexibility. So we think about location freedom, hours freedom, but actually there's a whole lot more that goes into making a company appealing, and what people want from their next company will vary significantly from person to person. So employer value proposition is a fancy way of saying basically what the company can offer an individual as well as salary to encourage them in exchange for their skills, I suppose. So things like salary goes into it, but also like reward and recognition, progression, flexibility, work environment, benefits, diversity, culture, mission, vision, sustainability, all of those things.
That's really cool. And on that topic, you're a remote first company and you have a dog friendly office in London. Is that right?
Yes, we are remote first. We have core hours about 11 till 3. Dog friendly office that's totally optional for people to use. But we say that people have to come in once a month. But we do like a big team get together where we pay for travel and accommodation and lunch and dinner and team building. And then we've also got kind of lots of additional stuff like 45 days of holiday in total or work from anywhere scheme. So we really try to walk the walk as well as talk the talk.
That's fantastic. And you co-founded Flexa with your partner, is it Maurice? Is that right?
Morris,
okay.
Yep.
and you said you have a CTO by the name of Tim, is that right?
Yes. That's right. Yeah. So Morris and I kind of had the idea for Flexa back in 2019 and realized that very quickly that we couldn't build a website at all. And so we thankfully met Tim on AngelList and he joined us and we launched Flexa in February 2020.
First of all, thanks for taking the time out of your very busy but flexible schedule, sounds like, to join us today. One thing that we hear a lot in the tech world are companies espousing RTO, return to office policies, even though they have like no proven benefits and the flexible working options to make work more accessible, inclusive, maybe aren't as strong as it could be. Why do you think there's this trend now that we're seeing of companies mandating a return to office and the figuring out of DEI and how that affects these policies? And what do you think in your ideal, and maybe it's the policies you have at Flexa, are the better solutions for what we're seeing right now?
I think there are so many reasons that companies are doing RTOs. And when we talk about return to office mandates, obviously it can vary from asking people to come back in one day a week, 2 days a week, 3 days a week, all the way to the full five. And I think what is quite often portrayed in the media is that any return to office is inflexible. I actually really disagree with that. I think a lot of people conflate the idea of flexibility and being fully remote, and that those two things have to exist together in order for it to be actually flexible. I really don't agree with that. I think different people want different things and different companies have different working environments based on, you know, their goals and based on their cultures. So I think as long as there is a degree of location flexibility, so it could be 3 days a week in the office, 2 days a week from home, that is someone's idea of flexible working. I think return to office mandates start to become problematic when they are used as a proxy for performance. It's a very lazy way of measuring performance, is by saying, well, I'm assuming that when I can see you at your desk, you are therefore working really hard. And I think the full RTOs of those 5 days a week are happening because of a total fear of the unknown from leaders who have built their careers in in-person settings and who don't know how to lead in any other scenarios. But then you start to layer on the fact that obviously, we came out of a pandemic, like a lot of the stock markets have been incredibly volatile. A lot of companies that were consistently performing for years are starting to underperform. And I think RTO and blaming flexible working has quite a complex relationship with a lot of CEOs trying to buy time and blame something that isn't their own controllable factors. So I think we've definitely seen that. You know, some examples would have been Manchester United, where they've demanded a full RTO. They have not been, and I'm not a football fan, so I'm not hating on Manchester United, but like they have not been performing brilliantly. And I think that was flexible working was used as a scapegoat there to buy more time and to say, hey, there was something wrong, we're addressing it. And then that naturally buys leaders 3, 6, 12 months until they have to it gets disproven.
And this is for their back office, right? Because clearly the players.
Yeah, the players have to be there.
Right, okay. Just remote to clarify work for our audience.
Yeah. For the back office.
Explain United's recent form.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's what a lot of people joke about when I talked about it on TikTok and LinkedIn.
Yeah, remote goalie.
Yeah. They're
like, which explains a lot.
They all seem to be working from home at the moment.
Yeah. Ooh. Oh, yeah, I like the spicy hot take.
And I think there's also another really interesting one that's around the fact that full RTO mandates are 5 days a week. There's naturally going to be attrition as a result of that.
Yeah.
We've all seen mass redundancies in the news. A full RTO is a very easy way to do forced redundancies.
Yeah.
Because people will opt out.
I think CNBC called it like layoffs in disguise.
Yeah, exactly.
They said that, you know, they were sort of daring employees to quit.
Really, yeah, and yeah. Elon Musk, when he took over Twitter and turned it into X, he was the first person to do that, right? Mm. He said, you've got to be in the office 5 days a week or you're not committed to this company. Mm. Loads of people left, and then all of a sudden it was flexible again.
Whoa, wow.
And obviously layoffs that disproportionately affect people like new mothers, new fathers. Yeah.
Mm. And that's where it starts to become super problematic, is because if you are using layoffs as a way to force redundancy or force people to leave, you've got to remember that you're not going to have an equal representation of people leaving. Sure. You are going to have diverse and minority groups that are going to be the first ones to leave. Sure. There are loads of studies. There was a massive one done by McKinsey in 2022 that showed that women, people of color, the LGBTQ plus community, people with disabilities were significantly more likely to leave if flexibility was removed. And so I think unless companies start thinking about that consequence, they're going to have a diversity crisis down the line.
We've seen this at we run a 4-day work week at Liberal Humans, and we've seen this anecdotally with our team members who, you know, we had an intern who was a young Muslim woman of Bengali descent who, you know, used her Fridays to help her sister care for, you know, her nieces and nephews and things like that. We have folks who care for other family members who have dementia and Alzheimer's with their extra day off a week. And, you know, maybe even if a parent is doing well, they spend that time to go to like a painting class with their mother, you know, a designer who does that. So we've really seen that affect, you know, women and people of color and folks from different economic backgrounds and how they use that day, that extra day. So it's been fascinating to watch.
Exactly. And there's also a feeling of, I think, safety at work as well. And there's some really interesting studies around the fact that flexible working is anti-racist, and also for the LGBTQ community, because a lot of people aren't necessarily out at work or they don't feel like they are their full selves at work. And same with people of color, there's microaggressions within offices, or not even necessarily that micro, still a lot of systemic racism. And so going in and facing that 5 days a week must be exhausting, right? Yeah. Whereas maybe having to do that 2 days a week makes it feel more bearable.
We had a young Black autistic designer who joined our team and was doing like a residency, and you know, getting into like social situations in the office was very, very challenging and something he preferred not to do. So we worked out an arrangement where he could work from home most days, but also, you know, we'd pull him in every now and then to like socialize with the team, which he found really valuable. The team really loved, but it was just finding that right balance, you know, and like really trying to have a workplace policy that allowed us to get, you know, what the company needed from his role, but also to allow him to feel safe and, you know, protected and able to kind of work and enjoy it. So
yeah, and that's exactly it. Like, I think flexibility gets a bad rep from the media in particular about being really one-sided, like it's saying, oh, people just want to work less hard, they want to work on their own terms. They're not being realistic about it, they're not thinking about businesses and profit anymore. But flexibility is a two-way street, and that's a perfect example, right? It's about giving freedom within a framework that balances both individual but also business needs and goals, and to be able, you know, what we need to do as a kind of collective group of people trying to push forward the future of work is start to produce enough evidence that it means that people saying, oh, 5 days a week is more productive, you can be like, no, it's absolutely not. There are a couple of studies out there, but there's not enough rigor within it, because there hasn't been enough time since the pandemic kind of forced this movement.
I'd say in the future of the work conversation, we're kind of awash in a lot of acronyms, right? And like a lot of jargon, stuff like that. And so I want to key in on two of them specifically, DEI and EVP. And if you could explain for our audience that, you know, the link between DEI and EVP, and how does, you know, there's been a lot of talk of performative DEI and how that negatively impacts EVP, and how can companies like embed DEI thinking into their EVP efforts? To use more jargons and acronyms.
So DEI, or diversity, equity and inclusion, completely agree, has become quite performative in the last few years. And I think it's because companies are slightly at odds of what to do to solve the kind of crisis that they have on their hands. When I say crisis, it's not one that's worse than like the company's literally burning down, but a lot of these companies have made commitments in 2025 or 2030 to be at a certain proportion of women or a certain proportion of people with disabilities, whatever form of diversity it might be. But these companies are nowhere near those goals. And so I think there's been a lot of sort of knee-jerk reactions to try and make themselves seem like they are supportive of diverse individuals. You know, it's Pride Month. You see suddenly the flags absolutely everywhere. Mm-hmm. That is performative DEI. One of the most impactful ways that a company can genuinely improve DEI in their companies is by creating inclusive working environments. Flexible working and being open about exactly what you offer and being very transparent about it upfront means that people are able to make an educated decision about whether or not a company is the right place for them. And for minority groups and diverse groups, that becomes particularly important. As you said, carers, people with parental responsibilities, people with disabilities, conditions, whatever it might be, they're much more likely to need like specific ways of working. So thinking about your EVP, employer value proposition, as we talked about before, when it comes to inclusivity is super important. You think about how much location flexibility can mean that people with disabilities or people with autism, neurodivergent individuals can comfortably work. Flexible hours and parents, you know, all of those different things. And so I think it's important to think about how inclusive your EVP is and how much it supports people, because then diversity becomes quite self-fulfilling, because there's representation within an organization. The people that you hire that are of diverse groups don't arrive, go, oh, actually, this is absolutely not what I expected, and then immediately leave again. And so it means like naturally you're going to be able to build a much more inclusive and diverse company because you've created the foundations to support them.
Yeah, with a low attrition rate, so people can rise through the ranks as well.
Exactly.
So we've touched on the stigma around flexible work. What are your predictions for the trends that will shape work in the coming 5 to 10 years?
So I'm hoping that the stigma around flexible working will start to dissipate, but I don't think it will ever fully disappear. I think one of the driving forces of removing the stigma of flexible working is if it's availed of by everybody. Because I think as much as there is obviously an incredibly positive impact on diversity in companies when there is flexible working, and the majority of people that will probably say that flexible working is a non-negotiable will be diverse and minority groups. But what's really important is the normalization of that. So companies making flexible working available to everybody without having to give a reason for why that person might want it. Because the risk, if only diverse or minority groups are the ones working flexibly, is that they are seen as working differently. So you've got everybody else working normally, and then leadership goes, all these people have to work in a different way. And also from a progression and a recognition and a general work perspective, there's a risk of othering those groups of people. So as more people that don't necessarily need, in inverted commas, flexible working start to avail of it because it might be that they're just a bit more productive in the morning or in the evening, or they like to go to the gym at lunchtime, or they want to visit their family in a different country and work at the same time. You know, those reasons are seen as maybe less important, but it's actually incredibly important for the progression and normalization of flexible working that is happening as well. So I'm hoping that will make a difference.
It's almost a shame too that, like, you know, with the, like, I think the pandemic and the push, you know, like sort of people being pushed into remote work, good that happened in many ways, but also bad in a sense too, because I think it like narrowed the conversation about like everyone's just, oh, at home working in their PJs, like doing the laundry while they're working and stuff like that, instead of broadening the conversation into like actual flexible work. Like, what do we mean that someone can be in office but maybe go, you know, pick up the kids or go to the gym in the middle of the day, and like all the different ways you can actually have flexible work, rather than just this like sort of myopic conversation of like full remote or full in office, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So, yeah. And I think that saying that remote working is the most important element of it, or to your point, like only really considering that, is actually holding flexible working back quite significantly, because then you also get these very heated debates that say like, well, not everybody can work flexibly. It's like, well, there can be different kinds of flexibility for people that still have to be in person in factories, for example. You know, different shifts, paid holiday, paid sick leave, enhanced parental leave, like those are all ways to add flexibility to people that cannot work from home.
Yeah.
And so I think we're not advancing the conversation enough by just focusing on location flexibility.
And yeah, in terms of like advancing the conversation, I imagine language like remote working isn't the most helpful, because there is that implied distance and perhaps distance from the cause, distance from the work itself.
Yeah, exactly that. And I think when we think about advancing the conversation, I think often we get taken a little bit far away from what the actual purpose is. And like throughout history, it's always been that people have complained about people wanting to work less hard when there's been a bit more technological advancement and there's been a shift in the way that we work. Like if you look at, you know, in the early 1900s, when Ford kind of reinvented the production line. He reduced hours and raised wages because he realized that he could make it all much more productive. And I read a really interesting article in the FT earlier that around that period of time, there were loads of newspaper articles going, people don't want to work hard anymore. You know, people are less committed. They don't have the same work ethic. And it was all because of this advancement. But all we're trying to do is make quality of life better for people by embracing technology. And I think very often, yeah, this remote in-office fight really takes us away from that core cause. And to come back to like the predictions of it, I think what we will see is that, yes, the stigma will be removed a bit, but I don't think we'll ever see, you know, oh, everyone's going to be working from anywhere, anytime, asynchronously. There's a really interesting study that was done by and is continuing to be done by some Stanford professors around office occupancy. And people seem to be working from home about 30% of the time, which has come down quite significantly from even when we came out of the pandemic.
Wow.
So it's sort of done this like little dip. And then I think actually what we'll see is more like a Nike tick shape. So I think it'll kind of come back up to, in all likelihood, 40-50% of the time is when people will be kind of working remotely. But I think to the kind of other conversation that we've had around that grey area, we'll see much more focus on 4.5-day weeks, 4-day weeks, mm-hmm. how we can support parents, how we can support carers, like different elements of the EVP mm-hmm. that will hopefully advance the conversation, not just for office-based workers.
Some interesting data from the Wall Street Journal, just that they found that people who work from home are promoted 31% less, and that 90% of CEOs say that they're more likely to prioritize promotions for in-office employees. So just to your point around that stigma and how like it's currently showing up in the data around what's actually happening in the workplace. And there's you know, nothing maybe more convincing arguably than who gets promoted and who doesn't, you know, in terms of and how that follows along lines of class, race, ethnicity, all that stuff.
Yeah, there's just so really much bias involved with it. Yeah. And now we've got this conversation of visibility creating more bias again.
Yeah.
So I think there needs to be a lot of focus. And I know that there is in particularly like very forward thinking companies and some HR tech companies of how we consider measuring performance mm-hmm. because we're so used to, because work used to be very homogenous. Mm. You go into an office 5 days a week. So it's very easy to just say that it was based on lots of inputs that people could see, mm-hmm. whereas we really need to move to outputs, like actually what is moving the needle, mm-hmm. Rather than people sitting at their desks from 8 until 6 and being seen as a really good worker because they're there all the time.
Yeah, I would love to hear more about how Flexa works with these flexible companies and whether companies come to you who aren't flexible and you sort of, is it their EVP that you look at and then help their employee branding and sort of create their strategy, or is it another method?
So for the companies that come to us that are flexible, and companies can find out if they are, like we've built this sort of benchmarked index where company goes on and tells us what they offer, and then you're either above or below average. So for the companies that are flexible, we just make sure that that's actually true, because there's been so much catfishing of working environments. Like I'm sure that you've seen loads of job descriptions on LinkedIn get called out where it's like, oh, we're remote, but actually you need to be in the office 3 days a week. It's like, no, that's hybrid. And when LinkedIn first released its kind of like remote in-office hybrid filter, apparently, and I don't know about the rigor of this data, but I can believe it, about 68% of companies said that they were fully remote and only 18% of them actually
wow.
were.
Wow.
So there's a really big abuse of trust, I think, mm-hmm. from the candidate mm-hmm. perspective, where companies are really optimizing for applications, mm-hmm, trying mm-hmm. to catfish. So what we do at Flexa is verify that the information that companies have told us is actually true. And we've looked into actually like what goes into a great EVP. So, you know, we'll look at factors like location freedom, hours freedom, but also senior leadership role modeling, whether there is actual diversity in that company, trust and autonomy, work-life balance, you know, all of the things that genuinely do matter. And we conduct like a very quick but anonymous employee survey with a statistically significant number of employees within an organization. So that can be thousands if it's a big organization. And then all that information is aggregated and then displayed on Flexa. So if people really care about location freedom, then they'll see the companies that ranked highest for that. So they don't have to go into an interview and ask, you know, what's on offer, and then waste everyone's time, because sometimes companies aren't even comfortable disclosing that at interview stage. It'll only be at offer stage. And I think that lack of transparency is quite broken, given the variety and difference in terms of flexible working environments and what people's preferences now are.
Absolutely. And that sort of abuse of trust and those 68% and 18% figures that you've just mentioned, so interesting, because it literally shows that companies acknowledge that a flexible working situation is much more attractive for future
exactly.
employees. yet lie about it.
Yeah, and it just seems like, you know, they want to get people in and then sort of try to persuade them. I don't really know what the end game is. I think a lot of, again, it's about measuring performance. I'm sure a lot of people are incentivized based on, like, you need to get this many applications. Mm-hmm. Whereas actually it should be about how many people did we manage to bring through to kind of final offer stage that were a great fit. Mm-hmm. I think there needs to be a big kind of rejig of the way that things are done. And in my opinion, it needs to be a little bit more like marketing, where you've got this top of funnel brand awareness, you know, building employer brands for companies based on what they truly offer. So naturally you're going to have maybe a list of 10 dream companies that you know lots about that you maybe want to work at in the future. Then their middle of funnel, where you then go from awareness into consideration and where people might apply to a role. And then the bottom of funnel, just a general candidate experience, interviewing, actually being hired. But that top of funnel has been missing from that process for quite a long time, and I think it makes it really inefficient.
And so you're about to launch Flexa Insight Beta. So could you explain what that is for our listeners, and yeah, how will it help employees improve their DEI practices and EVP?
So for companies that aren't flexible, there's a limited amount of information out there on what they should do. Mm. We also work with companies that are flexible in Flexa Insight, but I think one of the most interesting use cases is, you know, how does a company make a business case for flexibility? How can they show that if they want to hit X DEI goal or hire Y kind of person, that they really don't have that working environment set up correctly? So because of the fact that we've sort of existed through a paradigm shift in the way that we work, and we've been collecting data throughout that whole time, we've got 4.5 years of supply and demand data. So we know, you know, being able to split it by demographic, exactly what senior women in tech are looking for. We know exactly what Black engineers are looking for. Mm. We know what people with disabilities that are working in marketing, what they're searching for. So we can help companies to understand exactly how they need to change. Mm-hmm. And we've trained a machine learning model to interpret that and then make intelligent recommendations to companies based on their specific goals. So we're working with a few big enterprises at the moment on, some are flexible, some aren't, on helping them to reach particularly their DEI goals based around how they should adapt their EVP and how they should talk about it on job descriptions, careers pages, in interview, etc.
Obviously, this podcast is very interested in recognizing sort of the good, bad and ugly of sort of the uses of tech in industry. What roles can tools like AI and NLP play in EVP, and also what risks are you sort of aware of and mitigate against?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question. I think one of the biggest risks is kind of being unaware of the fact that AI has just as much bias as the data that it's given. And I think often people assume that kind of insights and interpretations are less biased when it comes from technology. Sadly, that's not the case. And I think when we're looking, I've heard a lot of companies talking about using AI to weed out, like, not weed out, but do the first kind of screening of applications, and say, oh, we're bringing these people through to a first stage interview. And that's one area that I would be quite concerned about, because I think from a bias perspective, like, yes, humans have it, but if you're not really overseeing that and there's no human checking there, and then I do think there's a general risk that internalized bias kind of comes through. But I think there's also huge potential in particularly in being able to show in big data sets like ours, that we've got 100 million different data points, and like, we as humans, that would take a very, very long time to synthesize that, pull out all those insights, and then be able to tell companies based on what they want to achieve, you know, what they really need to do. So from our perspective, that's been game changing, but we're always very, very conscious of sense checking, making sure that it all looks correct, and not always just relying on the artificial intelligence insights that we've been given.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, also I imagine just sort of from the data collection perspective, having clean data about, for instance, that first stage, even if it is done by a human, it's very useful to have data that makes legible these biases that are already sort of very much part of our decision-making processes.
Exactly. It's just speeding up the synthesis of enormous amounts of data. And I think from a time-saving perspective, that's also huge, because we also, we're sure in our careers, we've all sat there looking at spreadsheets for hours, whereas actually the amount of time that AI can cut out of that is genuinely incredible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We'd love to get a little bit more into the Flexa story and your story individually, and look, we'd be remiss if we didn't ask a growth strategy question. We're a growth strategy agency. You've got incredible branding. I love the Gen Z forward, colorful branding you've got on the website. We'd love to hear how you plan to grow Flexa from here, and what the guideposts look like on your growth journey for Flexa.
So we've always had quite an interesting go-to-market and growth strategy, just because we are not quite a marketplace, but B2B2C. So the reasons that companies come to us and are so excited by what we do is because we've got millions of users on the other side that are looking at those companies. So liquidity is obviously key, but they start to kind of self-reinforce. So we've had lots of companies that have come in as leads that the individuals have seen our candidate ads when they've been job hunting, and then they've remembered and then they've come back. And the same with on the B2B side. If a really notable and exciting company comes on with a great EVP, then we will naturally, by advertising that, then amass many, many more people because they've also got their own audiences. So we really benefit from network effects, and we're always very conscious from a marketing perspective of how we leverage those. And that has been absolutely massive for the kind of growth that we've had. Like, we're at just over 2.5 million users now all over the world. And we wouldn't be there without leveraging all these little network effects that we can see. Same as from an SEO standpoint, like now, if anybody searches like Mars Flexible Working or BT Flexible Working, like we're the first results that come up.
Nice. Well done.
So like, yeah. I know how hard naturally that is. All of those little things start to really, really matter.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, as we grow from here, we've now probably hopefully laid the foundations to be able to leverage hundreds of these different network effects, and we just want to continue to grow and grow and grow that. And now, as we've talked about with Flexor Insight, like all of the data that our core platform is generating, we haven't done anything with that yet. Wow. And so I think building all of that into Flexor Insight is another really exciting way to service segments of the market that we couldn't before because they're inflexible.
I literally just like licked my teeth because that's so exciting as a content marketer to hear. Yeah. You have all this data from the platform that you haven't yet leveraged.
Yeah.
And to like be able to put that into a content strategy that does some of the things that you're talking about. Would love to turn to your founder story, and you've got quite an interesting one, and one that's unfortunately familiar to a lot of our listeners in terms of, you know, what caused you to kind of get into this. But you founded Flexa in 2020 after being fired from your role at an investment bank, having asked for flexible work options to manage your autoimmune symptoms. So would love to hear more about that journey and just like sort of what brought you to the point you're at today where you have 2.5 million, you know, folks on your platform. Amazing, amazing journey there.
Yeah, it was a bit of a mad story, and like it was kind of a delay. I got diagnosed with an autoimmune disease when I was about 18. And it's really severe during like my final year of university and then into my kind of early career. And so about once a week, like I couldn't walk, my feet would swell up, my hands would swell up, my face would swell up. Like, it's not something you want to go into an office with, nor something sometimes was it something I literally could get into an office. I was like wearing slippers on my commute to try and get in. Like, it was bonkers. But I kind of struggled through about 18 months. And then they said to me, well, you can put in a flexible working request. And I was like, amazing. Sounds like the dream.
And this is before the pandemic and all the... Yeah, exactly. Before, I'm sure as an investment bank, they were incredibly understanding.
Well, I was really surprised to begin with. I was like, wow, they'll let me work from home one day a week. Yeah. So I put in that request to work from home one day a week when it happened. Mm. And 10 days later, they sent me to an occupational health therapist who recommended I was registered disabled because of the severity of it. Mm. And then I got pulled into a room and a settlement package was put in front of me, and I was told to leave immediately. So I then went into the job hunting process because I came out of university like and straight into that job, so I hadn't really done it before. I remember meeting dozens of other people, predominantly working mothers and people with disabilities, mm-hmm. that said that it was almost impossible to find full-time work that they could manage their lives around. So I started, you know, genuinely looking at working part-time, even though I was fully able to work full-time if I just needed to work from home if I was sick. I spoke to so many recruiters where they were like, no, then no one's going to look at you. Mm-hmm. If you want to work from home one day a week. I just remember finding the whole thing so frustrating and so nonsensical, because I was perfectly able to work.
Right.
I had a first-class degree. I'd got into a really competitive job, and I was like, why am I seen as such damaged goods? Sure. Because of needing to work from home one day a week. I went into the first company I went into was like quite flexible, but it was clearly damaging the way that they perceived me. I then left to go to a slightly more what I thought was a more flexible company. And then I ended up taking like pictures of my swollen feet to justify working from home, selfies in hospital if I ever ended up there.
To prove to them, like they didn't believe you. And so
literally didn't believe me.
Wow, wow, wow.
Then I ended up at a really flexible company, genuinely. And, you know, you could work from home 2 days a week. There were flexible hours, which was actually a game changer for me because often it would stop me sleeping. So then if I was waking up at 7 a.m, or when I was in investment banking, 5 a.m. to commute, it was hellish. So I'd have had 2 hours sleep, which then made me sicker and sicker. And it was this like full downward spiral. But you could go into the office at 11 and no one would bat an eyelid. Obviously, you'd finish your work, you'd be leaving later. But this whole like sort of trust-based flexible working environment was a completely foreign to me. And I asked them why they didn't shout about it, because the recruiter that I'd got that job through did not talk about this at mm-hmm. all. They were like, well, they seem pretty open-minded, so I'm sure you can ask when you get there.
Yep.
And that was all I could do at that time. I was like, sure, I'll take a punt. So I think it was really interesting speaking to them, and they were like, well, there's nowhere to shout about it, really. Like, where would we put it? We don't get that many people to our careers page. We use recruiters, so, you know, where would we showcase it? And I remember talking to my now husband, who's my boyfriend at the time, about it, because he was leaving his job, which had flexibility. And I was like, welcome to my life. Mm. Like, now you're going to try and find somewhere with flexibility as well. And he was like, surely this product has to exist where you can find out what it's like to work somewhere before you actually go there. So that was in the pub in 2019. Mm. And here we are.
Yeah. It's funny. That's exactly how Literal Humans got started. Met my co-founder and we had a drink in a pub and we're just talking about marketing and realized that we had all these complementary skill sets. And then, you know, the next year, middle of the lockdown, I was like, do you want to start a marketing agency? And sure enough, he was silly enough to answer yes. And here we are.
The pub's a great place to start a business.
It really is. It really is. There's something about it that just relaxes you and gets you more comfortable with making potentially bad decisions. But anyway, would love to hear a bit more too about, you know, being a woman who's a founder as well. And that, and also any advice you have for co-founding couples out there. So like two big questions packaged in one, but yeah.
Yeah, two big questions that have definitely held us back.
Yeah. You mean people won't fund you because they know you're a couple?
Sadly less, actually. Yeah. So attack of the cover one first. People hate it. Absolutely hate it. We've had people pull out of a funding round because they found out we're a couple. We weren't intentionally hiding it, but it was just like, this was our second funding round. I'm quite public about it. Like, I have a lot of people follow me on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
So I assumed that kind of people knew.
No.
But it came out with in due diligence, obviously. And we were really shocked. It was only a small investor that pulled out, but they were like, I'm not willing to take this risk. And I think really depends on the kind of person that you meet.
Were they hurt by a couple at some point in their past? Yeah. Or
I think a lot of it's projection.
Yeah.
I think they're like, if I worked with my partner, I'd kill them.
Yeah, so, totally.
Which obviously, like, different vibes at, I'm sure, you know, I've been in past relationships where I absolutely cannot work with that person.
Yes.
But also, you know, Morris and I work incredibly well together. We have quite different skill sets, but also we work quite similarly. So for us, it's been a game changer. But there is a lot of bias around it, I think, just because people make assumptions. And I think people also assume that there's more risk involved. And like, I understand it from, like, if we got a divorce, then yes, it would be quite tricky from a flex perspective. But one of the biggest reasons for startups failing is founder fallout.
Yeah.
There are not very many couple founders out there that I know of, increasingly a few more, but like, you know, they're not the main cause of founder fallout. I always said, like, the number of people that were starting businesses in 2020 that, like, maybe vaguely knew each other at uni, they were a couple of lads in their early 20s, I was like, they don't have a history of dealing with conflict, of having difficult conversations with each other, of working through problems, whereas couples do. And I think also, if you are willing to go into business with the person you're in a relationship with, you've got to have a lot of faith within that, because if you don't work well together, it's gonna be a disaster for both your business and your relationship.
Absolutely.
People don't want to throw that away.
I feel like if I was an investor, I'd be like, oh, they have more opportunity to work on this business all day.
Well, that's
like,
literally what happened,
which is problematic. But
we go to the pub, we talk about flexible, we talk about flexible.
But you must have to, like, carve out time, like, okay, we're gonna not talk about flexo, we're gonna just, like, you know, maintenance our relationship, and kind of do you try to build those boundaries?
We actually don't.
Oh, interesting.
My work-life balance is having a total lack of boundaries, so I find it easier to just sort of just have continual integration where
let it flow.
On a Monday morning, we'll take it a bit more slowly and walk the dog, but then it might be that on a Saturday there's a load of stuff that needs doing and we'll take it to the pub, common theme, and work through it. So for me, the total lack of separation, and same with Morris, I find that the easiest, because I actually find the switching off and trying to compartmentalize more stressful.
Yeah, it's like everything in moderation, even moderation, right? Isn't that the quote? Like, you kind of, like, you can't always be, like, super strict about things.
Exactly.
Interesting. I like that. That's cool.
And then the female founder side of it, like, I think it gets easier as your business does better, naturally, because you've got more proof and evidence behind you to push away from the bias that naturally exists. But fundraising is hard. I've been asked some pretty outrageous questions, like whether I was thinking about having children and would that not impact my ability to run the business. I think as a woman, you have to divulge a lot more information about yourself in order to try to get rid of the biases that exist within people's heads. You know, I've heard all sorts of things that women start female-led businesses are less VC backable because of their nature, that we have too low risk tolerance, which is funny because my risk tolerance is actually incredible, probably too high. And Morris's is a nice, like, calming low. I think there's just a lot of inherent bias that exists around female founders. And I think what's very difficult, and the study that I often point to, is a machine learning model watched 1,000 pitches, and some were male founders only. Some were mixed founding groups and some were female founders, and found that a woman's presence on a pitch team was neutral at best. And the only time that it was neutral was when the woman displayed characteristically female traits: smiley, warm, non-confrontational, not combative, submissive. But a female presence was negative when they embodied male traits. So confident, sometimes combative, sometimes pushing back on things, more direct, more forthright, which is very difficult because those kind of people are more likely to start businesses. And so I think it's a really difficult balance of both being a woman and all of the assumptions that are put on you, but then also if you move away from them, you are seen as too aggressive, too combative, too arrogant. So I think we have both the natural bias that we have to fight against, where, you know, less than 2% of funding goes towards women, despite the fact that we make up a significantly greater portion of startup founders. But also there's this very difficult societal sexism that exists around how we need to behave. It's a bit depressing.
Yeah. So you're expected to some degree step out of, you know, your femme coding, as it were, but not too much, because like if you do that, then you're like sort of breaking down the mental model that unfortunately a lot of these usually male VCs have for women. So it's like you're stuck, you know, it's a double standard, dare I say. But like that's
exactly that. It's a double standard. And then there's all the assumptions of, for some reason, everybody assumes that a woman is just about to have a baby at all times.
Yeah.
It's like, well, not necessarily.
Yeah.
Or, you know, is gonna put their home life or their relationship above everything else, and that's never a concern for men, which I think is deeply unfair, because, you know, hopefully we're moving much towards a society where the share of household chores and childcare becomes more equal. I've heard these horror stories of women that are building femtech businesses, obviously half of the global population are female, and yet they're then told that no, that market's too small. Oh, I've never heard of a woman needing that. It's like, but you aren't the oracle of what women need and what the market size is. You know, period products, and then they're told that the market's too small.
Yeah,
it's genuinely mental. I think there's a lot of it's a very myopic view, because everyone assumes that their own opinion and their own take on something is totally correct.
Yeah.
And so having a load of men in a room assessing femtech companies is not particularly helpful.
No.
Or it's like male contraception. No, the market's too small.
It's like, because no one I know will take that. It's like,
yeah, there's no demand in the market. There's the problem, boys. You know, we need to... Yeah, I mean, I think we had Tang Gu from Pact VC, and they're fantastic, you know, women-led VC, and they fund, I think, almost exclusively women-led ventures. And I think there's a big reckoning that's overdue for the VC in terms of them being the authorizing environment for a lot of tech, like what gets funded, what doesn't, what gets sort of lifted up as like products that have demand or don't. And so we talk a lot about that on the podcast, and hopefully it's coming soon. You know, maybe we need like some sort of product to change VC. I don't know.
But that has to happen, right? Because there needs to be representation. Like if I look at our cap table, the majority of our external capital is held by women. That's no coincidence. As a female founder that was leading on fundraising, like that's one of the things that I do, is I go out and have these conversations. And depressingly, as a founding team, we've had conversations about whether I shouldn't do that.
Wow.
Because my odds are lower. Even though I would naturally be the person that would go out and pitch.
Wow.
So I think there needs to be more representation. There needs to be more women making decisions, because again, like coming back to the whole diversity argument, diversity of thought, diversity of experience, diversity of backgrounds actually enhances company performance and enhances profits and enhances decision and innovation.
Well, we're hopeful that, like, you know, with like tools like Flex Insight, like you know, folks can get that data at least to be able to make some of those decisions.
Improve it.
You know, that's it's a shame we have to go in that way, like prove the business. But I mean, it's a moral thing to do, but also it's a good business thing to do, you know, to have more diverse workplaces. So thank you so much for your time, Ali, for coming in to meet with us. Really appreciate that. You're very busy. Where can folks find out more about the good work you're doing at Flexa on the interwebs?
So either flexo.careers, that is a website. Everyone always asks me if it has something at the end. No, it's flexo.careers. Or follow me on LinkedIn, because I post about pretty much all of the stuff that we discuss on a daily basis.
Well, thanks everyone. This has been another great episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast, brought to you by The Real Humans. We've been joined today by Molly Johnson-Jones, co-founder and CEO of Flexa, and we spoke about the future of flexible and diverse workplaces in tech. Thanks again, Molly.
Thank you.
And folks, please, as always, like, subscribe, share, give us a 5-star rating for Tech Can't Save Us so we can get more great guests on the pod like Molly. Thanks, everybody. Have a good one.